the middle of interesting times when it comes to city, state, and federal dynamics. During the past 8 years, the Massachusetts Attorney General, now our governor, and other state AGs focused their fire at more conservative federal policies, major pharmaceutical companies, and tech companies and their labor practices, just to name a few. In her first year on the job, Attorney General Andrea Campbell has picked up a few of those torches and introduced some of her own, even directing the state's fire at its own cities and towns over a controversial housing law. I'm Jennifer Smith, and this is The Codcast, Commonwealth Beacon's podcast about policy and civic life here in Massachusetts. Today I'm joined by Attorney General Campbell to reflect on the past year and dig into how the former Boston City Councilor has approached the thorny questions of local versus state control. Attorney General, welcome back to The Codcast.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see you.
So before we get into the nuts and bolts of housing law and local control, I want to start, because we're recording this on Friday the 12th, by touching on a new federal gun rule. So the Biden administration finalized a rule this week that expanded the definition of licensed firearms to close the so-called gun show loophole. You worked in support of this rule change. Mm-hmm. It's, of course, we should probably know, going to be slash almost certainly going to be challenged by groups like the NRA, who argue that it infringes on Second Amendment rights. But do you want to basically talk about, one, why was this mm-hmm. something that you were pushing for, and then your response, since it was, I think, announced today as we're recording that the rule has been finalized? Mm-hmm.
So one set of issues we're absolutely going to prioritize is everything, of course, having to do with gun enforcement and gun violence. We established, under my leadership, the new Gun Violence Prevention Unit, and that team has hit the ground running for sure. There are a few areas of focus for the unit. One is working with our national partners and other AGs across the country on pushing for legislative changes, regulatory changes, policy changes to close any loopholes. This was obviously a significant one, and one that folks have been talking about for, frankly, way too long. It's just too easy to get guns. This is one way to prevent that. But the office looking here in Massachusetts is, of course, always looking to enforce our gun laws here. There are people coming after them every single day, it seems like. We have the most progressive gun laws in the country, and they are under attack. And so I don't want to undermine that. Our lawyers and our staff and my team are working hard every day to enforce our gun laws, while at the same time showing up in the State House to expand our regulatory framework to include ghost guns, for example, which are unregulated, which is another part of our gun problem. And then lastly, we want to be intersectional in this work. There are ways in which to support community-based organizations that are breaking cycles of gun violence, and so we want this new unit to focus on that too. So all of this is happening in a very intersectional way, and I'm really proud of the leadership, not of myself, but really of this office and this team to tackle these issues that are front and center, I think, for everybody.
So speaking of departments in your unit here, one of the newer ones that you've announced is a housing-specific focused department. So as a quick update, what's the purpose of this housing unit and what are the areas they've been focused on so far?
So this is still getting off the ground. We posted for the new housing unit, and we are actively going through the interview process. It was actually a unit I did not campaign on. So I campaigned establishing the gun violence prevention unit, the reproductive justice unit, the elder justice unit, and the police accountability unit, all of which we've gotten off the ground and really proud of that. The housing unit came about because of not just the conversations around the MBTA communities law and my obligation and responsibility to enforce that law, but the fact that housing and affordability are probably the number one issue that folks are talking about.
And for those who are not familiar with the MBTA communities law, this is a law that says that if you are within a certain distance of public transit, you have to zone for a certain amount of multifamily housing.
It is too expensive to live in Massachusetts. And we know this isn't just an issue around housing and in access to housing, but it also affects our economy. It affects who can stay here. It affects the demographics of a community. You can't have, say, younger folks or seniors who are being priced out, right, and expect to have robust and inclusive communities. So the housing unit is designed to work with municipal leaders, stakeholders, community-based organizations, developers, anyone and everyone who is figuring out how to comply with our zoning laws, land use laws, in order to bring about more affordable housing, or I would say more housing that is affordable and accessible to communities. We have a municipal law unit right now, ably led by Margaret Hurley, who runs our Worcester office. But how can we make sure that as we're doing the work in that municipal law unit, as well as our, say, civil rights division, taking on folks who are being discriminated against in terms of access to housing, that that work is more intersectional too. So there's a real need on the housing front because the issue is so prominent, but also because we have a real leadership role that I think hasn't necessarily been acted upon really and focused on. And so we're going to do that through this new unit.
Gotcha. So let's take a little trip back in time for not just you, but also me, which is before you were AG, you were a Boston City Councilor.
That's right.
That's when I first started covering you. And you're
the first journalist to interact with me that I've ever interacted with. You were the first years ago during that city council race for District 4.
I don't want to think about how long ago that was. But you know, you're a resident of Mattapan. And so for those who don't think a lot about Boston geography, that's one of the southernmost neighborhoods of Boston that actually abuts the town that we're going to be talking about in part, Milton. So I wonder if you could think back at the time to when you were a city councilor to the way you were thinking about state versus local powers, because Boston, of course, knows that you can't even get more liquor licenses without going to the state and knocking on their door and saying, please and thank you, can I have more liquor licenses? But zoning tends to be something that's largely left to the cities. So we'll get to the legal part of it, but just from kind of a resident as a city councilor, how were you thinking about whose responsibility it was to create housing? Back when you were just someone who mostly lived there and mostly worked in local government.
I think at the time that I was on the city council, of course, focused on housing. It was an issue then. It's only been housing affordability issues exacerbated, frankly, over the last 10 years. But I focused my attention on, one, the zoning process at the local level and what type of development would come into District 4. Making sure that it was units that were affordable or where appropriate. There were some communities that said, we want some market rate units or a third and a third and a third. So making sure the voices of my constituents informed what was coming into their community in terms of the housing development proposals. But I also focus on the funding piece, right? My first piece of legislation was a Community Preservation Act, which of course is still generating millions of dollars for the city of Boston for the development and creation of more housing that is affordable, as well as parks and recreation and other things too. And that was the lens, less so about what the state could do at that time. The only context really engaging with the state was on the CPA and how we got the Community Preservation Act, the CPA, into Boston as it had, of course, been passed in other municipalities across the Commonwealth. So engaging with folks around how do we do it here in the city of Boston. Now, from where I sit, understand the importance of local control. And I would stress that to municipal leaders, including in Milton. I'm always applauding municipal leaders for the work they do because I don't think they get the gratitude extended to them. You're also the person at the grocery store who is either being yelled at because you're not doing a great job or being applauded because you are. So they are the first point of contact in many ways for the constituents' issues, right? The job here is to work with municipal leadership. And in the context of the MBTA Communities Law, we've done just that. From the beginning, put out the advisory to say that law is mandatory, because there was a lot of questions on, is it mandatory? Is it voluntary? And many municipal leaders said, thank you and extended gratitude for us doing that, because it made it clear what they needed to do within their community. The other piece that I think is really important is offering that technical assistance. So we do that through our municipal law unit, also working with the housing agency, Secretary Augustus. Technical grants are given to communities to help them come into compliance. So we continue to offer up that support and people continue to come to us. The bright spots are, and frankly, this needs to win the day. Milton is an outlier. Most communities are coming into compliance. The rapid transit communities are in compliance. All of them, the only one that isn't, is Milton. And so we have continued to work with Milton every step of the way. And then obviously kept my word in terms of suing this municipality because they choose not to come into compliance because it's my job to enforce the law as it is. But the second piece that I think is really important is every step of the way we've shared what we want to do, and now we have to rely on the court. But that's not the norm, and didn't take this action on lightly. Would prefer to work with municipalities to get this done. And as I ran into someone recently from Dedham, who's on the planning board, who said, we've done it, and we're working to come into compliance. It's not that difficult and hard. Working with your office has been great. We want to continue that, and hopefully Milton comes into compliance really soon.
So part of this whole thing, and again, part of why your sort of literal location is so interesting, is a big part of this is actually turned on the deeply adorable trolley system that stretches from Ashmont.
It is an adorable system. It's a great system.
I will say, and this is something that we haven't spent a lot of time talking about when it comes to the MBTA Communities Law, but, you know, there are also plans to literally upgrade the Mattapan system. Full disclosure, hope that all of the little PCC trolley cars, when they get removed, all turn into little pop-up cafes or something somewhere. But regardless, I am curious, again, kind of thinking back before you were in this position, how did you think about the trolley? Would you have thought about it as kind of rapid transit, or does the colloquial definition of rapid transit differ from the way that the state thinks about what counts as rapid transit?
Those definitions might. In our job, and the housing agency and Secretary Augustus and his team would agree that we have to go by a definition that exists. And Milton, of course, like every other rapid transit community, has been fully aware of what that is. They receive funding from the state and from various sources to support that system. It's a public good that they have access to. I have access to it as well, living in Mattapan, and have taken the trolley and used the trolley to get to Ashmont to go downtown. I think that question has been asked and answered. And I think people forget that they are going to get significant improvements to that line. And as they build more housing on the line, there's more development actively happening. It is readily available to folks to take and, of course, to be a transit-oriented community. And the whole point of the MBTA Communities Law, which, of course, was passed by a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature, so a real bipartisan effort to address this housing crisis in Massachusetts, was to say we need to come together and not have something that's voluntary as other housing laws have been in the past, but to have something that is mandatory and that will force all of us to play a part in addressing this housing crisis that has only, frankly, gotten worse. And if you have this public good available to you, there is an extra responsibility you have to create this housing and to help the state deliver housing for folks. And most importantly, to improve your own community. And what I love about this law, too, is not just that it's mandatory and the legislature was crystal clear on that and that we have to enforce it. When you think about the history of housing laws in Massachusetts and this country, they have been exclusionary, excluding certain people from living in a certain community, including myself, right, and folks before me, cutting off their ability to not only choose where they would want to live, but also the ability to buy a home and build wealth for their families. This law allows us to focus on the housing as a tool to close the racial wealth gap, to create more inclusive communities, and is very inclusionary in its intent. That's a beautiful thing that I think sometimes gets lost in the conversation. So our job in enforcing this is to make that clear. And to say to Milton, again, working in partnership, never, you know, making the residents of Milton villains in this. They are not. But being flexible in how we enforce it, but saying we have to enforce it. Otherwise, Massachusetts is going to look very different if you have folks not only leaving because they can't afford to live here, but if you have folks unwilling to come here to bring their talent, their innovation, the workforce here in the healthcare context, other contexts. So this law is significant for so many different reasons. And we are doing our best, of course, to enforce it. And hopefully we'll get to a place where Milton comes into compliance like every other town we've been engaging with.
How have you thought about the kind of interesting dynamics of the Milton vote? Because, of course, for context, for those who haven't been following it really closely, the town meeting did pass a plan that would have brought it into compliance with That's the right. MBTA Communities Law. And then there was a special referendum that essentially undid that, where voters said, we do not actually want to pass this plan. And so, if I recall correctly, even though it was weeks ago, so we'll see how I do, when the lawsuit was announced, part of the question was, you know, what does it mean to be suing the town of Milton in this situation? What do you do when a lot of the objection is coming from people that say, well, I always understood that the history of local control in Milton or anywhere else means that when the voters decide they don't want their community to look a certain way, they get to say no. So how have you approached that feeling, that sentiment? Because they also make legal arguments that are saying that in kind of a more literalized way.
So in some contexts, that may be true, that you might be able to say no at the local level, but it's probably rare. The state trumps, and it's as simple as that, and we make that clear. And I'll give you an example. There have been conversations in the past on whether or not municipalities that control most of the school funding and things related to education in school should have a 180-day school year. and that was asked and answered and ultimately litigated, where the court said the state wins. We have the power because of the laws we operate under and the Constitution in Massachusetts to enforce and implement our laws for the betterment and the public health and the safety of all of our residents. And in that context, we did in the educational context, 180-day school year is the law for every school district. And then the districts have the ability, of course, to figure out what type of curriculum and other things that they want to do that might be unique to their community. Here in this context, we've made it clear from the very beginning, while there may be some level of control over some aspects of zoning, in this case, the state trumps. You have a state law that is mandatory that certain municipalities with this public good come into compliance with this law over a period of time, and that they have to not only enforce it, but have to build that as a right, reasonable housing for a family within a certain area of their community. And there is some flexibility, not on the enforcement of the law, because we win that because the state trumps, but there is some flexibility that they do have. And for example, Milton said, where we have this transit, there's not enough land to build this housing. So what the state did was go back and say, okay, we're going to update our regulations to offer you greater flexibility so that you don't have to build it near the transit line. You can build it elsewhere in Milton. And so then, of course, people got together and developed that plan. So the people don't get to win the day when it comes to the enforcement of this state law. And I think we're stressing that. But obviously the average person, and let me be clear, the average person, some followed this, but not many. You know, the numbers are always low when it comes to voting and civic engagement, sadly. And we're not going after a no vote. If anything, we are going back to the community and the town itself to say you have an obligation to enforce this law. We're going to continue to work with you to do just that. And you can't stand in the way of this enforcement, and that we want to bring about greater housing in Milton, but do it with flexibility that you deserve and that you're entitled to, but not for the question of whether or not your zoning laws will trump the state's. They don't. Mm-hmm. And that's just basic, you know, law 101 that we also have to educate people on. And we'll continue to do that.
Not to torment our listeners with a tremendous amount of legalese and legal timelines, but you had asked the SJC, the Supreme Judicial Court, to basically hear this as quickly as possible because there are other deadlines. This is a rolling deadline of law. There's a bunch of deadlines coming up at the end of the year for the bulk of these kind of middle category transit communities here. It's not going to be fast-tracked. So what does this look like now, given that, you know, it might be dealt with over the next few months, but all of these cities and towns are trying to develop their plans and figure out, do I want to push back? Do I want to amend it? So what was the mindset going into asking it to be moved as quickly as possible? And then how does it impact the plan that it won't be going as quickly as you would have liked?
I will say, because we've been reasonable every step of the way, working with municipalities, right, including Milton, this is the law, it's mandatory, it's not voluntary, given resources and technical assistance to bring them into compliance. When we approached the lawsuit against Milton, the same was true, very reasonable. We're not going in seeking a whole host of remedies. We're seeking just a few things. One was to say, court, we need you to confirm this law is mandatory. Second, we need you to confirm that Milton must comply and come into compliance with not only the mandatory aspect of the law, but also that our advisory that we put out is the law as defined by our office. And we're waiting on the court to do that. The good news is the court said, we will listen to this, we will take this, and we will have the full court assess your legal arguments and theirs, which is a good place for us because they're saying it's a matter of law and not facts. The second is we would have liked the timeline to be sooner. We recognize they have a very full docket.
I hear there's a few ballot questions that they might need to kick around.
There's a few things going on. So we, of course, wanted a shorter time frame just so that there's no confusion out there. And this can have the effect of creating or attempting to create confusion. And so the court put that off until October. That's fine. It's still enough time. And so we want to continue, of course, to make our arguments, and we will, that we have the authority, one, to enforce this law. The second, it is mandatory. Third, Milton must come into compliance. And then we're going to continue to work with them on doing just that, while not making this an adversarial process, there are a few that I think are attempting to do that and suggesting that we have not been reasonable or working with the community. That's just not true. We have been every step of the way, and we will continue to. There were folks who said, well, you should challenge the ballot itself. We are not in the business of overturning results of an election. Not at all. What we are in the business of is enforcing laws. In this case, this particular housing law, because the housing affordability issue is so crucial. It was on the cover of the Globe today. And as someone remarked from a municipal leader, actually, who said, you can get a lot of funding for the schools in our community. It won't matter if nobody is living here. And it's just as simple as that. You can't have folks serving you in a community at your local coffee shop, your local library, your local dry cleaners, your local healthcare institutions, if you do not address this housing crisis and this affordability crisis immediately. And we have said there is a role for the AG's office to play in the housing context, not just the governor, but us working with the administration. And we're going to do that.
I want to be sure to touch on a few different polls. So we're in the middle of, for those who aren't aware, a real poll-a-palooza over here in Mass Inc. land, because Commonwealth Beacon has partnered with GBH News through the Mass Inc. polling group to put out a whole bunch of polls on a whole bunch of subjects. One of them that I think we can kind of touch on quickly is around the MBTA community's law. And it had a very kind of interesting, does this describe NIMBYism? Does this describe something a little bit more complicated question, which is half of respondents said that the MBTA Communities Act is good policy. But then 41 to 31% said that the state should not be able to force communities to comply with it. So does that feel like a dissonance to you, or does that feel like a reflection of the way that people tend to think about local control?
I don't know what it is. And I'll say this. We do our work not focused and informed on what the polls say, but what people say. And what I mean by that is, I'm not sure what the questions entirely were.
It was pretty much that exactly, which is good policy, bad policy, don't know. Should the state be able to enforce? Should municipalities be able to opt out, essentially, that kind of thing?
And I think if we were conducting that poll, we would have framed it very differently. Hmm. We would have asked folks, do you think there is a housing affordability crisis here in Massachusetts? And overwhelmingly, we already know the answer to that. People would have said yes. Do you think that everyone in Massachusetts has a role to play in addressing it? That it can't just be, for example, cities and not towns, or it can't just be the poorer communities that are addressing the housing crisis, but not more of our affluent towns. And so for us, everything we do is informed by people and by our mandate to enforce the laws as they exist. And right now we know housing and housing affordability is the number one issue. And we don't think that any one community should have to bear the brunt of responding to a crisis. All of us have a role to play. And in this case, we have a law passed by a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature who came together to say, these municipalities that have this public good have a responsibility to help us solve this housing crisis. Put aside the other municipalities that don't have that public good available to them yet, but at least one tool that we have is this. And the MBTA Communities Law is, I think, and can be a very effective tool to solving the housing crisis if we get folks to come into compliance, if we say that every municipality that has this public good has to come into compliance, and if they do the work, of course, of building housing that is accessible and affordable to the folks that need it the most. And as that person in Dedham, but every other municipality, frankly, that has been screaming for some media attention because they're like, excuse me, we're coming into compliance. Why is no one talking to us?
They'd like gold stars.
they really would. I think they would like 3 gold stars because it's not just the leadership of that town that's doing it. It's the people and the residents coming together to say, okay, how do we figure out how to do this? How do we build one area? And mind you, it's not numerous areas in the community. It is one area to build multifamily housing as a right that is close to where the transit is to make it transit oriented, which also helps with our climate goals, and to bring this housing online as soon as we can to address this housing crisis. People are rolling up their sleeves every day in these municipalities to get it done. And when I say Milton is an outlier, it's an outlier. And of course, for every poll, I ask who was polled, where, when, because I think if you went into Lexington, Brookline, Dedham, even Boston or Quincy, and folks talked about their work, to actually bring their community into compliance and to address this housing crisis, the numbers would be very different.
Gotcha. And I think one other thing that I want to be sure to touch on, because it's also a recent issue and we also did a bit of polling on it, is the question of youth gambling, sports betting, the impacts of the changes to that industry since it became legal about a year ago. We're at
That's
almost
right.
exactly
That's
a one-year
right.
mark here. And that there is, as we've talked about, both the concern about and then also the difficulty given sort of limited data with how to kind of get your hands around the issue of youth gambling. So this spring, you announced a coalition, not just of your office, but also gambling assistance groups, sports teams to try and address the issue of youth gambling starting at even a pretty young age. And I guess where I'd like to start, even though we're rapidly running out of time, is just how do you think about youth in this situation? What does it mean when you're talking about young people getting into gambling? Because not to tell on myself as a millennial, but I hear I don't count as a youth anymore.
I don't either.
I know, exactly.
We're getting older. One, I want folks to know I take on this responsibility and address the issues not just as attorney general, but also the mother of two young boys. And when we develop our strategic plan, there are five pillars in that plan, but one pillar, an area of focus, will be everything having to do with our young people and the well-being of our kids. Tackling the mental health crisis we're seeing here in Massachusetts and, of course, in this country is front and center, and we're going to direct resources and human capital and our attention to that. And then the other is their economics. And we see the betting conversation, frankly, straddling both. On the one hand, we know that if you become addicted to gambling and betting, it can have mental health effects. It can also lead to substance use disorder, alcoholism, and lead you into debt. So this coalition, which I'm really proud of, every major sports team in Massachusetts, frankly, the Gaming Commission and other stakeholders coming together to say, how do we develop a curriculum and be more proactive so young people understand what the laws are, that you cannot bet when you're a young person, that you are prohibited, including between the ages of 18 and 21, which has been a real question, that you know what those laws are, that you also know what the risks are, and that if you actually choose when you're of age to go and place bets, that you're mindful of the risk and where it can lead you. I'm not opposed to betting. It is the law of Massachusetts, but we want it to be safe, we want it to be responsible, and we want to work with operators and others to do just that. So it's a continuation of the work we did around the regulatory framework to protect young people and to make sure ads were not directed to them on social media, et cetera. But now we have an opportunity to do that in a school-based context through some curriculum development and continue to have conversations about the prevalence of ads and other things. And this coalition will be useful, especially the sports teams, because I don't think young people are the most excited to listen to their AG. I think they're more excited to listen to the players of these sports teams. So we're thinking creatively about how we do this, and we're having our first meeting in sort of in the weeds and the details coming up the end of this month. And I know the operators are also looking at this as they have formed their own coalition with resources. And we're in conversation with them about how do we bridge some of these conversations to work in partnership? Because no one wants to get to a place where we see this spiraling out of control and young people illegally betting or ending up in debt or ending up with public health concerns that affect all of us.
Last question is maybe the broadest one, so your answer might be the shortest, which is one thing that we found in this polling is consistently the lottery is the dominant gambling enterprise of the state across all age ranges. The thing they played more than anything else this year, more than sports betting, more than horse racing betting, more than keno, everything is the lottery. And there are once again pushes from both the governor and the House of Representatives here in Massachusetts to bring an iLottery or a version of the lottery that is online into fruition, which has in the past run into issues with the state Senate. So that might still become law. So how are you thinking about Massachusetts's approach to a regulatory framework that really does seem to be consistently in favor of let's really double down on state-sponsored gambling, state-regulated gambling, just maybe don't go to New Hampshire to gamble.
In the same way, right, we got the law, it was passed, and immediately had to roll up our sleeves to develop regulations around sports betting. And this is, of course, betting that is already can lead to addiction on an addictive device. We add the lottery to this mix. We can sort of end up in a place we don't want to be, particularly the public health risk. So we're going to do the same thing. We will work with the state if this were to become the law, which isn't yet. It maybe never will be. These are conversations for the legislature to make sure it's safe and responsible. So the same sense of urgency we took with the operators on sports betting, we'll do the same if this were to become law.
Thanks again to Attorney General Andrea Campbell for joining me on the podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer Smith. Our producer is John Gee. Leave us a rating and review wherever you're hearing us now if you want to help other folks find us, and email podcast@commonwealthbeacon.org if you ever want to get in touch directly. We'll be back next week.